Welcome. My name is Sloan Schumacher. I'm the Executive Director of Wilderness Workshop. This evening's presentation is a collaborative effort between us and Earth Justice. Of course, we're the local grassroots conservation organization, place-based. It's our work. And Earth Justice is the national pro bono law firm. Earth means good lawyer, and Earth Justice provides us. I'm going to start by stepping back a second and say this is Wilderness Workshop's 50th anniversary year. We've been at this a long time, and a lot of good has come from our work. And I want to recognize Connie Harvey here sitting in the front. Connie was there at the inception, and we owe, and Jim Ward, I noticed, is here tonight too. Jim was an early guy. I don't know if you're there at the very beginning or not, but these are the giants whose shoulders we stand on. Their early work is responsible for half a million acres of designated wilderness that we are graced to live surrounded by. So thank you all for your work. Wilderness Workshop has got a slate of events this year. Please, if you're not on our mailing list, please do sign up. You can do it on the internet. Go to our webpage. We have a bunch of fun things going on, serious intellectual academic discussions like this, as well as things like our Wild Fest, which is our annual community celebration of our shared love of public land. So please join us. Wilderness Workshop has had a long and interesting partnership with Earth Justice. In fact, Will, our conservation director, is on Earth Justice's board, and one of their key staffers in their Denver office, Ted Zukoski, is on our board. So we're pretty well intermixed that way, and it's great because Earth Justice is a kick-ass collection of attorneys doing some of the cutting edge work that's keeping our air clean and our water drinkable and our wild places wild. So we're really pleased to work with them. Particularly, we've worked closely with them on the Thompson Divide effort. And you're familiar with the Thompson Divide effort, right? Somebody knows what that is? Please. And it was a very close collaboration between our attorney Peter Hart and another attorney out of the Denver office, Michael Freeman, that resulted in BLM canceling 25 leases in Thompson Divide last November, and we'll hear a little more about that from Peter. So we're really excited to be together with you guys at Earth Justice here in Aspen, and so I'll start by introducing this is Drew Caputo, did I pronounce it right? He's their Vice President of Litigation at Earth Justice. He's out of their Oakland office in San Francisco. To his right is Peter Hart, our staff attorney. And to his right is Will Grouse, our conservation director. And we're going to hear from them in that order. And then after they have a little presentation, we'll open up the Q&A. We're really excited that Aspen Public Radio, KJAX, is recording this tonight to be used later in their programming. And I think it might be a little too long for them to broadcast the whole thing, but we're hopeful, you know, that the most poignant and salient parts will make it on the air. So during the Q&A, we're going to ask you to please ask your questions through this microphone, which will get you the question onto their recording so it can be heard on air if it's selected. So we'll be passing this around. So without further ado, thank you, gentlemen.
All right. So I'm going to stand up. Just because I got a law degree, I have to stand up. It is a real pleasure to see you all here on a Wednesday afternoon. It's a weird time for everybody who cares about public health and the environment. So I'm going to take 15 or 20 minutes, and I'm going to really try and do two things here. One is to tell you a little bit about Earth Justice and what we do. And the second is to talk about what's going on environmental law, politics, and policy. Nick, I wonder if you could turn the sound down because I'm getting some feedback. I can also take off this Britney Spears contraption. If that works better. I think that's better.
Best to keep it on so we get on the...
Okay. So I know some of you are familiar with Earth Justice, but I think many of you are not. We are an organization. Our original model was that we are the law firm for the environmental movement. So, and what we believe in more than anything else are two things. We believe in the power of law and the power of partnership. I want to sort of unpack those things because they tell you what we're about. Power of law is that our role in the environmental community is to go to court to protect public health and the environment and to give a voice to the environment and people who care about the environment. So we have 100 lawyers on staff arrayed around the United States, from Hawaii to New York, from Alaska to Florida. And every single day, those 100 lawyers go to court to fight against dirty sources of energy like coal-fired power plants and fight for clean sources of energy like wind and solar power and energy efficiency, to fight for clean water, clean air, against toxic pollution. And the part of our docket that I love the most is we protect the most valuable public lands, the most imperiled species, and our oceans. And we do that by filing lawsuits against federal government, state government, and every industry you can think of. That's our role. And when you think about the political and economic power of our adversaries, we are David and they are Goliath. And I'm happy to tell you that we win way more than we lose. And that happens in part because we're good, but it also happens because our cause is righteous. And it's righteous on the merits, and it's righteous because people care about clean air and clean water and wild places and environmental justice. So that's what we do. That's the power of law piece. The power of partnership piece is that we never do any of that alone. What we do is we go to court, but we never sue on our own behalf. We always sue on behalf of another organization. So, for example, one of our most important clients here in the Rocky Mountains is Wilderness Workshop. We couldn't do our job of using the law to protect wild places and the environment if we didn't work in partnership with Wilderness Workshop. And I like to think that they couldn't do their job of protecting these places nearly as effectively without us as their legal arm. And that's how we work in every single case. We represent environmental groups, big and small, big groups like the Sierra Club, medium-sized groups like Wilderness Workshop, tiny groups, grassroots groups that spring up around a particular issue. And our arrangement with our clients is always the same. We don't charge them a dime for the legal services that we provide to them. We ask them to cover our out-of-pocket expenses, like airfare to the courthouse or filing fees. But those are a pittance compared to the cost of employing a lawyer. So that, what that means is that we give away for free millions of dollars of the highest quality legal services to worthy environmental groups like Wilderness Workshop every year. And that's made possible by the people who support us as an organization. So that's Earth Justice. Thank you. Okay, now I want to talk about what we're facing. And it is not hyperbole to say that we are facing the most anti-environmental presidential administration since the advent of the environmental movement. There have been other presidents who have been skanky on the environment since the environmental movement started. But, this president has appointed his Secretary of State as what used to be the head of ExxonMobil, and his head of EPA was a guy who made his chops as Attorney General of Oklahoma by suing EPA for doing too much to protect the environment. And the list goes on. So it's a problem. It's a problem in terms of what they campaigned on. It's a problem in terms of the appointments that they've made. And it's a problem in terms of the agenda. And they control pretty much all the levers of government, except for the courts. And that's where we come in. Because our strategy
is a combination of Winston Churchill and the Gregory Peck character in To Kill a Mockingbird. This is Atticus Finch, which is that we're going to fight them on the beaches and in the streets and on the fields. And we're mostly going to fight them in the courts. And we're never going to surrender. And we will lose some cases, and some of those losses will be too painful to bear. But I'm telling you right now that we will win a lot more than we will lose. And we'll do it because we're all going to come together. We wouldn't have as many people in the room today if the election hadn't happened last November. And I wish it hadn't come out the way it came out, but the advantage of that is that people are coming together. And working together, especially in the courts, we can protect the things that we care about. And that's what we need to do over the next 4 years. In terms of the administration's agenda, it's going to be bad. It is bad. I think there are areas of emphasis. I will put them into three categories. One is they believe in fossil fuel all day, all the time. I think, I was trying to figure out the best way to explain this. They have, their economic policy, near as I can tell, is a 1950s economic policy that says if you could produce as much coal and oil as possible, your economy will grow as fast as possible. And that is not only bad for the environment and bad for our role in the world. We're in a, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty embarrassed that China is more progressive on climate change than the United States of America. But it's lousy economics, too. If you look at the data from the beginning of the year 2000 to the end of the year 2014, which is the last 15-year period for which we have full-year data, the U.S. economy grew by 30%, measured by gross domestic product. And U.S. carbon emissions decreased by 10%. Now, that is proof that you don't need to increase fossil fuel production in order to grow your economy. And in fact, if you drill down on a state-by-state level, as a general matter, the states that grew the most during those 15-year period economically were the most carbon-efficient states. There were some exceptions to that. North Dakota grew a lot because of the oil and gas development in the Bakken area. But as a general matter, our most carbon-efficient states grew the most economically. They don't see it that way. So we're going to see an across-the-board push to facilitate coal and oil and gas development. Number two, these guys have a fetish for trying to reverse environmental progress by Barack Obama. If it's pro-environment and it was done by Barack Obama, they want to overturn it. Number three, the Trump campaign didn't have much of a policy infrastructure. So they're coming into office, and the guys that they're hiring are from industry. So in some ways, industry has taken over our government. And that's what we need to fight against. So I want to give you a couple of examples of how we're fighting on the national level. And then I'm going to sit down so we can hear from the wonderful folks at Wilmer's Workshop, and then we'll get to the most important part of this, which is your questions, which I look forward to answering. Last week, President Trump fulfilled one of his campaign promises, which was to end what he called the war against coal. So on Tuesday, he went to the Environmental Protection Agency and he signed an executive order that did a whole bunch of bad things on energy and the environment. One of the things he did was to direct the Secretary of the Interior to lift the moratorium on coal leasing that Barack Obama imposed at the beginning of 2016. Coal is the dirtiest fuel that we have in order to power our economy. And at the beginning of 2016, President Obama said, you know what? A lot of the coal produced in the United States comes from public lands, lands that you and I belong, that belong to you and me. And we're going to stop that for the moment. We're not going to interfere with existing leases, but we're not going to issue any new ones. And before we issue any new ones, we're going to do a couple of studies. One is we're going to look fully at the environmental impact of the federal coal leasing program so we can make intelligent decisions about what we want to do about that. And number two is we're going to look at the economics of it to make sure that federal taxpayers are getting a fair deal. So last Tuesday, Trump goes to the EPA, and he orders the Interior Secretary to lift the coal leasing moratorium. Wednesday morning, the Secretary of the Interior in Washington, D.C., Ryan Zinke, lifts the coal moratorium, issues an order saying the coal moratorium is no longer in place. You guys can issue new leases. And you know what we did on Wednesday afternoon? We went to federal court in Great Falls, Montana, and we filed a lawsuit against Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke. And we said, the order that you issued a few hours ago, it's illegal because you lifted the coal moratorium without doing any environmental analysis about what that means for air and water and species and the public land that you would issue those coal leases on. That's illegal. You need to look before you leap. See you in court. We're going to keep doing that because that's the way we're going to fight back. And filing lawsuits like that accomplishes two things. Number one is it makes them follow the law. They have to follow the law just like everybody else. Number two, it shines a light on what's going on. Is it a good decision to lease more coal on public lands that belong to all of us, especially since the coal industry is not only dirty, but declining economically because it's dirty? One way to get people's attention about that is to file a lawsuit. Now, I want to be clear, we're in it to win it. But the value of litigation not only is to force everybody to follow the law, but it's to make people pay attention to what's going on. Talk about one other example, and then I'll sit down. I mentioned that one of the things the Trumpies want to do is to overturn Obama environmental initiatives. And one of the things that they really want to do is reverse President Obama's designation of national monuments, especially here in the West. There's a wonderful law that was enacted by Congress in Theodore Roosevelt's administration in 1906 called the Antiquities Act. And it gives the President of the United States the power, with the stroke of a pen, to add protections to federal lands that are currently have few protections against resource extraction. And some of our most valuable national parks, Grand Canyon National Park, Arches National Park, Acadia National Park, started as national monuments, protected by presidents under the Antiquities Act, until Congress could get its act together and protect them as national parks. So President Obama designated a bunch of new national monuments, and the Trumpies want to reverse. So one of the most controversial monuments is the Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, which is an unbelievably stunning place. And it's also a place that is incredibly important culturally for Native American communities. And in fact, the political effort to persuade President Obama to designate Bears Ears as a national monument was led by the Native American community. It appears that the Trump administration is going to either try and reverse that monument designation or shrink its size on a scale of 70% so that it won't have what it needs in order to be a valid, viable, protectable national monument. And if and when they do that, we're going to do the same thing that we did when Secretary Zinke lifted the coal moratorium. We're going to see him in court. Because while the Antiquities Act allows the president to designate national monuments, it doesn't allow the president to undesignate national monuments. And it doesn't allow the president to shrink a duly established national monument by 70% to the point where it's a monument in name, if anything. Now, when we do that, that's going to be not only important to protect barriers and other monuments that I think are going to be part of this anti-monument push, but it's going to send a really important signal to the administration and to the American public and to the world at large. And that is that one of the things that makes America special is that nobody is above the law. Everybody in this room needs to follow the law. I need to follow the law. Donald Trump needs to follow the law. So with your help and your support, that's what we're going to do. And we're going to turn this moment of peril into a circumstance in which we all stand up and have our voices heard in and outside of court in favor of protecting the environment and public health. Thank you.
Is it on? It's on. That's a tough act to follow. and I hope I don't talk for quite as long. I'm going to talk from some notes. But I think, Drew, your message is hopeful, and that's sort of where I am today as well. Yesterday you talked about people coming together in the wake of the November election, and Wilderness Workshop has long been engaged in a coalition of smaller environmental groups that work in the Intermountain West that are trying to protect public lands from fossil fuel development. And that group had its heyday during the Bush administration, when places like the Piceance Basin were absolutely booming, when 10,000 oil and gas wells were drilled just down the road. And then it sort of went quiet during the Obama administration, especially in the last couple of years because commodity prices have been so low. But we were meeting yesterday in Denver, and it was interesting because I wasn't actually around at the beginning of the Bush administration, not doing what I do now. And so yesterday we met with these other attorneys and activists who are members of the Rocky Mountain Energy Coalition. And it was interesting to hear some of the old guard talk about how this administration, as scary as it is, has been a lot less effective in the initial weeks and days than the Bush administration was. And that was good for me to hear. I sort of feel like I've been reeling since November, trying to figure out how are we going to deal with this. And to hear them say, it's not as bad as it was, it could be worse, really gave me hope. And, so as I was driving home, I was thinking back to November, and indeed, you know, that month brought us a shocking election, but, you know, it also brought us a bunch of big victories. One of those victories was on November 17th, the BLM canceled 25 oil and gas leases in the Thompson Divide. That was a pretty sweet victory, and it was a result of a grassroots campaign that dated back to the Bush administration when those 25 leases were illegally issued. The Bush administration's lease before you look kind of drill baby drill agenda resulted in challengeable decisions and spawned a level of public interest that helped us win in the Thompson Divide. And we find ourselves there again. Hundreds and thousands of people, including locals and people from around the country, have engaged, and their engagement has driven that political outcome. There are more people now engaged than there were during the Bush administration. In that sense, we've got more power now than we've ever had before. The attention that effort, that one campaign garnered, allowed us to retain some of the best legal talent in the country. Earth Justice was interested in taking the case for us, and they've helped us all along legally. Pitkin County gave huge resources to that legal battle, and ultimately were critically important in us winning that battle. I should say, you know, despite that big win in November and that recent lease cancellation decision, our work to protect the Thompson Divide is not done. Industry has challenged that cancellation decision. We're going to have to fight to defend it. But the lesson between that Rocky Mountain Energy Coalition meeting and sort of my reflection on it driving home was that the seeds that we plant in dark times can grow into great things. And so I want to take the next couple minutes to talk about some of those seeds that were planted during the Bush administration that we continue to cultivate through the waning years of the Bush administration, through the Obama administration, and ultimately won. And all of these that I'm going to mention, we won with the help of Earth Justice. The first one that I want to highlight is the Roadless Rule, which was implemented at the end of the Clinton administration. And it was immediately attacked by the Bush administration and by industry. The Roadless Rule that was implemented in 2001. The rule was intended to prevent road building associated with logging, mining, and oil and gas development on 58 million acres of our wildest remaining unprotected national forests, including places like the Thompson Divide and huge swaths of the White River National Forest. The rule was the direct result of a tremendous outpouring of public support. Groups like ours, national groups like Earth Justice, regional groups like Conservation Colorado, helped generate huge amounts, unprecedented amounts of public comments supporting protection of roadless rule, of roadless areas. I think at the end of that process, the Forest Service had received more than 1.6 million public comments, which is more than any other administrative rulemaking process had ever generated to date. So immediately after the rule was implemented in 2001, at the end of the Clinton administration, it was attacked, and lawsuits continued. Earth Justice continued to defend that with help from place-based groups like ours, for 16 years. The defense continues today. I mean, actually, we're just talking about this. I thought that the last case was when the Supreme Court denied cert to the state of Alaska in 2016, but Drew corrected me and said that actually there is one remaining roadless rule case. It's an Alaska case that's currently pending before the district in district court in D.C. So that, you know, that battle is not totally over, but I will say that with the help of Earth Justice, we have won at every step along the way. And what that means is that you know, essentially 58 million acres of the last sort of best unprotected national forest land that we have will be protected from road building, which is about the most destructive thing that we could do to it. The second effort, the second victory I want to highlight is the Roan Plateau. So in the early 2000s, the Bush administration began, actually probably started before the Bush administration, but continued through the first term of the Bush administration into the second, began implementing or designing a plan about how to manage the Roan Plateau, which, if you're not aware, the Roan Plateau is sort of a big, massive plateau just north of Rifle. And it is considered one of the most biodiverse pieces of public land in the state of Colorado. And it's surrounded by 10,000 oil and gas wells. It's in the heart of the Pinos Basin. And for a decade or so, almost a decade, we worked on the planning process, urging the BLM to close that area to oil and gas leasing and development. And ultimately, the Bush administration implemented a plan that opened the entire thing and then promptly sold oil and gas leases up there. And as soon as they did that, Earth Justice, on behalf of Wilderness Workshop and about a dozen other environmental groups, filed a lawsuit, which ultimately resulted in a victory. There was an industry appeal of that victory, and then we settled the case, agreeing on a plan that would protect 90% of the Roan Plateau from future oil and gas leasing and development, at least for the next 20 years, for the life of that plan. And in so doing, we essentially saved the top of the Roan Plateau from thousands of new oil and gas wells. The next one that I want to highlight is oil shale. In the early 2000s, the Bush administration began looking at whether and how we should develop oil shale, which is sort of this most destructive of fossil fuels that you can possibly imagine. Developing oil shale, which is actually kerogen. It's sort of very premature oil and gas that hasn't been pressurized in any sort of liquid by, you know, thousands of years of geologic time and heat and pressure. There's a lot of oil shale between northwest Colorado and southwest Wyoming and then sort of the northeast corner of Utah. And so during the Bush administration, they amended 10 resource management plans and opened up 2 million acres of public lands to oil shale development. And we, again, participated in this process and fought throughout the public process for plans that would protect these areas and not open them up to a huge amount of oil shale development. But the plan that was ultimately implemented opened 2 million acres. And so Earth Justice, again on behalf of Wilderness Workshop and 15 conservation groups, filed a lawsuit. In 2011, right at the beginning of the Obama administration, BLM decided they would settle that lawsuit and that they would actually go back and revise those resource management plan amendments that they'd implemented. And so after working through that settlement, they agreed to a plan that in 2012 dropped that 2 million acre number to 700,000 acres, a pretty substantial victory. In Colorado, where we bought the harvest, the number dropped from 400,000 acres that were open and available to oil shale leasing to 25,000 acres. So a huge, huge victory here in Colorado. The last, where am I? Where am I? Okay, well that might be the last one that I actually want to talk about. Yeah, so I say that to give you hope. Hope that we know how to fight. Between the grassroots work and the administrative work that Wilderness Workshop is doing on a day-to-day basis to participate in these huge public land management plans and decision-making processes and the work that Earth Justice is doing in the courtroom, we've been successful before and we'll be successful again. So that's what occurred to me yesterday at the meeting that I was in, and I thought that was probably the most important message to convey tonight. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Drew. So I'm going to talk, is this working? Can folks hear me? Great. So I'm going to talk kind of about three things. I'm going to tell two success stories, actually, from the past couple of months. Sometimes it does feel kind of depressing, given kind of what we're hearing. I think a lot of us probably have inboxes inundated with kind of streaming alerts about the next bad thing, but there's some good things that have been happening. And then I'll finish by talking a little bit about kind of how people can get involved, how citizen action works, and really kind of how everybody can resist. So the success story. The first one is on the methane rule. This thing attached. So as Drew mentioned, one of the big objectives for the new Congress and the Trump administration has been to roll back a lot of some really good progress that was made at the end of the Obama administration. And one of those was something called the methane rule. And it basically said to oil and gas companies on federal lands, you can keep drilling for oil and gas, but you just can't waste methane. Methane is natural gas, is which we burn in our houses. But it's an extremely potent greenhouse gas. Depending on the time frame, anywhere from 20 to 60%, 60 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. And it also has some pretty serious human health impacts. It mixes with other compounds and can cause asthma in kids. So this was kind of a health and climate and really economic story, because that methane that's being wasted is not ultimately being sold to consumers, and so we're not getting royalties off it as taxpayers. But industry had this rule in its sights and made a pretty strong push for it right out of the gate. The House passed what's called the Congressional Review Act, which is kind of the nuclear option for getting rid of previous rules or protections. That failed through, and it was kind of expected that it was going to go through the Senate, the President was going to sign it, and that would be it, no more methane rule. We kind of were tracking this, and it was something we started talking to our members about, getting them to call in, and it was, we kept hearing, okay, the vote's probably going to happen next week, maybe in conjunction with this other CRA, and a way that's being put off and separated from this, and long story short, it just kept getting put off, and there still hasn't been a vote in the Senate. And the reason for that is there's probably about half a dozen senators, Cory Gardner, our senator from Colorado, who's a Republican, and relatively moderate on some environmental public lands issues. So this kind of group of senators was really hearing from a lot of their constituents, and people didn't want the BLM methane rule to go away. And so they slowed it down, and the leadership in the Senate basically said, we don't want to take this vote if we're going to lose. We need to win every time we win a vote. And so that's why they haven't brought the vote. is because there's been so many people calling into senators' offices. We've been working with Earth Justice and groups like Conservation Colorado, not only to get kind of that grassroots level, but organizing business sign-on letters. Aspen Steam Company, who's in the audience here, was one of 60 businesses who signed a letter from the West Slope to Cory Gardner saying, you know, this is really important to us. Please don't get rid of it. And so far we've held the line because people have been making a difference. So that's the first success story. There's plenty of CRAs that have gone through it. I don't want to sugarcoat it. The other thing I want to talk about is this effort to sell or transfer public lands from the federal government, from the Forest Service, the BLM, to the state. And, you know, this is a pretty fringe idea, kind of an outgrowth of the Sagebrush Rebellion that started back in the 70s. And it's been mostly concentrated at the state level until the Trump administration and this new very anti-environmental Congress. And now we're starting to see some efforts happen at the federal level, which is actually kind of where it gets scary. The states have very little power to actually transfer land, but Congress does have that power. And so two parts to this story. The first is the very first thing the House of Representatives did when they came into office was pass what's called a rules package, basically how they operate, how they deal with legislation. And it included in that was a provision that valued public lands at zero. And the reason they did this was not because public lands actually have no value or revenue, because we know that, you know, ski areas pay royalties, oil and gas companies pay royalties. But they did it because there's a bunch of fiscal conservatives in the House that don't want any legislation that would negatively impact the budget. And so if there was a bill to sell or transfer public lands, that would have a negative impact on the budget, and you wouldn't get those conservative budget hawks voting for it. And our Congressman, Scott Tipton, voted for that rules package. And he got a lot of flack for this issue, kind of this. You know, generally people don't pay attention to the rules package, but because of the public lands issue in it, they did. They started calling him. There was a lot of news articles about it locally and at the state level, even across the nation. And so just the other day, I heard an interview that Elizabeth from Aspen Public Radio did with Scott Tipton. She asked him about that. And his answer was not the most satisfying, but he said, look, I voted for the rules package because we needed to pass the rules package to operate, but I didn't like that provision, and I support public lands. And I don't know how much I believe him. His record on public lands is not good. But the important part of the story is that he knows he needs to say that when he's talking to people in his district. He has to say he supports public lands. And whether he does or not, you know, that pressure is pushing him more in that direction. So he knows this is kind of a bright line. The other story around this public land seizure that's even more exciting is that about a month or so ago, a congressman from Utah named Jason Chaffetz introduced a bill. You guys know all these stories already. it's like I'm narrating a sitcom. Sorry. But hopefully there'll be some exciting points. Anyway, so this congressman from Utah introduced a bill that would sell off more than 3 million acres of BLM land. And literally to the highest bidder, was, you know, because it has to go at auction, so he literally have, like, people in there bidding, you know, on the next place they're going to build their big vacation home on, you know, these amazing BLM lands around the West. And within days, maybe even hours, there was this massive outcry from across the West. If you went on his Instagram page or Facebook page, more than half the comments on every single post, regardless of whether it had anything to do with public lands, was about this bill to sell public lands. People who were his supporters, they literally said, I really like you as a congressman, but get rid of this bill. It's terrible. Paul Ryan went into his office and said, dude, pull the bill. This is really bad PR for us. I don't know if that's exactly what he said, but, you know. And so he got really hard. He got hit really hard on this, and within a week, he found a picture of himself in camo with a hunting dog and posted on Instagram and said, I'm pulling the bill because this matters so much to a lot of the people I care about, you know, probably hunting groups most importantly, but the outcry was across the West. There were rallies in Montana and Utah and New Mexico, and this was kind of that effort to transfer sell public lands, you know, the folks backing that are them sticking their toe in the water, and they got bit by a shark. And it's important not only because now there's you know, 3 million acres that won't be sold, but it built power around this. And I think in, you know, some of the battles that we'll see in the future, like on Bears Ears or in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, they're important not only because those places are important, but it's a way to draw a bright line in the sand and make sure that, you know, perhaps slightly lesser known areas like the Thompson Divide are also seen as part of this public lands issue, and they're just kind of off limits. So that's, you know, those are two exciting stories. And then I'll just end with kind of, you know, kind of what does this mean for us? How do we, you know, partake in citizen activism? And there's a little bit in those stories, but one of the things I've been thinking about is that my grandfather was really involved in the Sierra Club in the 60s and 70s and spent a lot of time working to protect lands in Alaska and California. And he was on their board, but he was a doctor. He didn't work for the Sierra Club. He wasn't paid. But he lobbied Congress, and he was quite instrumental. And as the environmental movement has evolved from the 60s and 70s, I think we've professionalized, and it's been good. We've got, you know, instead of Earth Justice as, you know, basically two pro bono lawyers out of an office in San Francisco, there's 100, and I'd rather have 100. But I think we've also, you know, lost something of the power of citizens, of people who aren't professional environmentalists, taking action. And you guys, are the most powerful voices when we're going to Congress. They know what we think. But when they hear from, you know, somebody who's a business owner or a mountain biker or a bird watcher or a mom, that makes a really big difference. And I think the silver lining, maybe even like the gold or platinum lining of the election, is that people are fired up, and it's good for right now for defending all these things we care about, but I think it's good in a much bigger sense of, you know, this is a way to build the environmental movement back to having that really key citizen component. And so it's really heartening. It's not easy. It's more than just taking action online. That's important, but it does take time. It takes organizing your friends to go on a visit to a senator or a representative's office. It takes writing letters to the editor, not once, but many times. You know, it takes programming into your phone the numbers of all your representatives and just taking 5 minutes every day to call them. I've talked to folks who are literally on a first-name basis with the guy who answers the phone in Tipton's office, and they're starting to build a relationship. And now when they call, you know, they listen. It's respectful, and it makes a difference. So there's a lot of hope. We've designed our Capital Launch program, which maybe a couple of people have mentioned. It's kind of an online advocacy tool to kind of provide you with the most salient and pertinent information to make it as easy as possible to kind of filter out, you know, there's all this stuff coming at me, what can I do? The idea there is to give you the tools to really understand the issues. But we want feedback on that. If you guys want to organize a meeting at a senator's office, let us know and we can help with that. If there's an issue you really care about, you know, you can become an expert in that and be a spokesperson on it over time. So maybe I'll end there and we can take some questions. I will mention, just so we don't leave out the advocacy portion of this evening, after it's all over, we've done the questions and Drew's going to say something, we'll be walking around with these whiteboards, and for those of you who have smartphones and are on social media, you can come up and take a picture of this and then just post it on your page, tag your congressman. There we go. You guys can take a picture and tag me. So we've got one for Cory Gardner on the methane rule, because that's still a live issue right there, and then Tipton on public land. So with a drink and an appetizer in one hand, get your picture taken. And yeah, now we'll go to questions. Make sure to use the mic.
Yeah, do you have the mic?
Great. We've got as much 20 minutes or so for taking questions, or we can move to cocktails sooner if no other questions. Yes, please.
Please say your name first for the radio.
My name is Bobby Carson, and I'm kind of new to getting involved in some of these things other than just exercising my right to vote. when you call, because I called the other day for the first time, when you call and a gentleman answers the phone who's in, say, Representative Tipton's office, and you state your concern and whatever, does that actually get to Representative Tipton? Do the people that are answering the phones, do they write that down and, you know, I think they ask me where I live or whatever. And
yeah, does it matter?
I often think, does my phone call really matter? Does it really get to the person that needs to hear it?
Yeah, the answer is definitely yes, and especially for phone call. They receive all sorts of correspondence and from congressional staffers that we've talked to, the phone call is the most effective. So, and the way it generally works in most offices is that there's interns and staffers answering the phone, and they write down and kind of categorize what is coming in, and then every morning the senator or the representative gets a summary of that. And so if they're getting a lot of calls on an issue and there's a vote coming up in 3 days, the senator or congressman wants to know where his or her constituents are, and so it really does matter. And that's kind of, you know, maybe specifically on a vote, but if it's even more general on public lands, if there's just kind of a ground level of, you know, hum on public lands, then they know this is something that, you know, they need to really be careful about and be thinking about. So it does matter. As a general rule, kind of the more effort it takes you to do whatever democracy you're participating in, the more effective. So, you know, more so even than a phone call is a visit to the office or writing a letter to the editor that gets in a, you know, a newspaper of record or something like that. But the phone call, as far as something you kind of do on a daily basis, is by far the most effective.
Would the letter that you write be in your local paper, or would it go to like a gender paper? Or?
Probably depends on the politician, and we'd love to work with you on that. Local papers are good. If you can get it in the Denver paper or the Grand Junction Sentinel, first got Tipton, even better.
My question follows right up on Bobby's. Mary Dominic Coomer, I also called Representative Tipton's office both in Grand Junction and in Washington, D.C. In Grand Junction, I got an answering machine and left my message. In Washington, I got a person, but I was doubtful whether he was actually writing anything down. And I've been told that number one, sign a petition. Next important is to make a telephone call, and most important is to write a letter, and then you're saying go to their office, which I don't think most of us are able to do.
Yeah, going to the office is definitely you know, a much bigger commitment, but it's surprisingly easy. There was a group of environmental educators from the Roaring Fork Valley who called Senator Cory Gardner's office and said, can we have a meeting? And they got a meeting with the head of the Colorado office. And they were talking about environmental education issues, so not directly on this. But most of the time, they'll take your request. Living here, it means you've got to get in the car and travel, and it's half a day or a full day's worth of work. But it's definitely feasible. In terms of kind of what folks have told you, I think the phone call is the most important. We've heard that from past congressional staffers, and it's kind of a combination of it taking some work, and they receive a lot, but not a huge amount. You know, they're getting tens of thousands of emails a week probably now, but the phone calls, they're kind of getting few enough of them, and they all are writing down what happens. So, and leaving a message is just as important. They'll come in and listen to that and take a tally.
And I would note that Representative Tipton is probably afraid to show up in our valley and have a town hall meeting. He knows what he's going to hear. But he is having one in Montrose on Friday night. I think it starts at 6.
Yeah.
We can send out information on that. And that is a great opportunity to get a carpool together and head over McClure Pass and show up and give him peace of your mind. Because... You know, he hesitated to have town hall meetings when early on when there was so much of a ferment, but he's finally come out of his foxhole, but not very far. He's sticking with the reddest of the red part of western Colorado right now. So. Another question?
On the petitions, if you go to the very last sentence on the pre-set up letter, if you put your cursor there and hit a return, you can add your own paragraph. So I've been adding things like, do your children breathe air? And, you know, just, I'm watching you. I'm paying attention to what you're doing. Do you think adding something like that at the bottom does any good, or would it be better if I could try to get it up to the top?
Yeah, put it at the top, or just write your own message in general. The more time it takes, the more personal it is, the better. So don't worry if you don't know how many, you know, exact acres would be hurt by this bill, or how many tons of carbon are at stake. You know, talk about your family. Make it personal.
Talk about values of importance. So I've got two over here, Lisa and then Sheldon.
Coincidentally enough, I was in both Tipton and Gardner's office today. So I just wanted to tell you that we did ask, and we were there, we said, so how does our information filter through? And they turned the computer around and they showed us their software. And yes, it does sound like, you know, phone calls are great because I think that is more personal and they're definitely tallied. So it is looks a little bit more problematic in their software to put letters in there. They kind of will put the topic. I said, well, do you scan the letter and put it in there and then discuss it? You know, so they were a little bit more murky about that. But I do have a question. And you did thank Gardner for not bringing the methane vote to the floor. So, and it sounds like his staff actually told us that it may run out, you know, the time period after the...
They've only got 60 days.
60 days is almost up. So they may be letting the time run out, just to let everybody know. So that was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And my question is how are we, this is such fantastic momentum. How are we going to, I worry about the future, I guess I shouldn't, but it just seems like there's, you know, obviously, you know, you talked about this, there's so much coming at us, so many different things, so quickly. So how are we going to keep this momentum into the future? How is Wilderness Workshop going to do that? I mean, are we going to get together another time and regroup? I mean, I'm trying to see what you guys think about keeping this momentum going, all this grassroots energy.
Yeah. You jumped in. Drew and I were talking a little bit about this beforehand, actually. But we're thinking about it. I think the key is, or one of the keys at least, is telling some of those success stories, making sure people know it's making a difference, and it is, but, you know, we need to kind of keep being reminded of that, because it takes work, just time, but also kind of the emotional fatigue if you feel like all you're doing is staying against a brick wall and nothing's happening. So making, you know, I think our job is to make sure we're being as strategic as possible, and we're picking those issues where we can actually move the needle. And Drew said we're going to lose some things, and there's some things that Senator Gardner and Scott Tipton are never going to move on. And so I think our job is to kind of, to be strategic, pick the right battles, and then, you know, make sure we're letting folks know when we win. And we won't win them all, but it's working.
Well, and this is a marathon, not a sprint, and we're all going to have to pace ourselves and go for a hike and recharge your batteries and come back ready to fight. Really. So,
thanks. My name is Leah Boucher. I'm with Indivisible Aspen. My name is Leah Boucher, and I'm with Indivisible Aspen. And I first have a comment and a question as well. Just to elaborate on the phone calls, I think an additional thing to consider is the phone calls really slow down the day-to-day for the congressional offices. They kind of sidetrack what they're working on, and they have to focus on taking your calls, and that in turn draws attention to it from the member of Congress. So just another comment on that. And my question is, With EPA cuts, what is the most concerning or the thing that is kind of driving your attention at the moment the most?
Well, I think this administration is sort of, with their budget cuts and their emphasis on facilitating fossil fuel production rather than protecting the environment, I think they're threatening to turn the Environmental Protection Agency into a non-governmental organization. I think we're going to see a lot less enforcement of environmental laws and regulations from EPA. And I think they're going to shift into facilitation mode for industry and states that want to serve industry's interests. And our response to that is twofold. The first is EPA has to follow the law just like anybody else. So if the Clean Air Act says by July 1st of 2017, you need to come up with a plan, EPA, to protect air quality in Aspen, and they don't do that, if Wilderness Workshop wants to sue, we're going to sue EPA and make sure that they follow their obligations under the law. In other words, they don't get to pick and choose everything. The other is, if they're not going to enforce the laws against industry, we are. And the limit on that is going to be the limit on the resources that we have to bring to bear. So I don't want to paint too rosy a picture. It's a bad situation. The guy who runs EPA thinks climate change is a hoax. But there's a lot we can do. And it's going to, I think at the end of the 4 years, we're going to look back and say, you know what? This would have been a lot worse if we hadn't done what we did.
I just had a follow-up comment to that, which I think that we are going to be looking to states, to certain states, to hold the line. And clearly New York and California, but I think we have an opportunity in Colorado to get a governor that is going to be a leader on holding the line about the things that we care about as well, and that's an opportunity we shouldn't miss. It would be huge because where the line is going to be held is at the state level and not at the federal level. And just to let everybody know, many people I'm sure already do know, that this Monday is the beginning of the congressional recess, so all the Congress people come home so they can be accessible and listen to their constituents. So one of the things you should do is call your senators and representatives' offices and say, gee, when are you going to make yourself available to meet with your constituents while you're home for the next 2 weeks? So.
Was that a question?
Hi, I'm Richard Heady. I'm a geographer and a climate scientist whose work holds fossil fuel industries, companies in particular, responsible for climate change and eventually for climate damages. And we've gotten under the skin of Lamar Smith, who runs the House Science Committee, who's the most ignorant Science Committee chair ever, as far as I can tell. And my question to you, Drew, is because I've heard that the Clean Power Plan is very difficult to unwind. You mentioned that it has to go through legal procedures that it might take years. But what about rolling back CAFE standards with not only the automobile industry, but the oil industry behind it, wanting to roll back fuel efficiency for automobiles?
I think that's one of the biggest threats we face because the climate progress from fuel efficiency standards in vehicles is hard to overstate. And the oil industry and the car manufacturers have a lot of economic interest in rolling those things back. I feel a bit like a broken record in telling you my response, but Trump campaigned like he could just come into office and wave his hands and magically things changed. And that is not how the law works. Everything the government does, it has to do in a, there's a law called the Administrative Procedure Act, federal law. It's the boringest law you could ever read. But it is one of the most important tools in our toolkit, because what it says is when the government makes a decision, it has to go about it in a reasoned, rational way. That doesn't mean you get to second guess the conclusion that they get to. If they decide, for example, to change the fuel efficiency standards, and that doesn't violate the Clean Air Act, which we will argue it does, the Administrative Procedure Act enables them to do that as long as they say, okay, here's the science, here are the facts, here are the conclusions, this is what we want to do. If, on the other hand, they just blow that away and say, we're just going to lift the fuel efficiency standards, we will sue them and win because they didn't make a reasoned decision. If they render a decision that says, the sky is green, the moon is made of green cheese, and I'm 6'8" and a movie star, that's also irrational. So my point is that none of this is a done deal. And our job as citizens and as lawyers is to hold them accountable so that they don't get to the end of the process.
I have an observation and a question. First on public input, Congressman Tiffin, Senator Gardner, Senator Bennett, they all have offices in Grand Junction. If you want quality input, those people are the people to talk to because they're the eyes and ears on the ground. And too often we get alerts to call Washington, D.C. Call the Grand Junction office. They have more time and they listen. Even if they don't agree with you, they're going to listen and they're going to report back to the boss. My main question is, though, the Trumpies are allegedly business people. And I read an article by one of Connie's sons the other day, I forget which one it was, that said it is now cheaper to build a new solar or wind farm from scratch than to operate an existing coal plant. So they're going to go out and lease massive amounts of coal. And Peabody Coal already has a 10-year backlog in Wyoming. Don't these Trump people understand economics? That, to me, is the biggest hope to defeat a lot of Trump's proposals, because the market forces, hopefully, and I hope you guys would comment on that.
I think it's a very wise question. I think coal is failing, not because of regulations, but because it doesn't make economic sense. Now, the fact that it's bad for the environment is part of the reason why it doesn't make economic sense. Let me give you an example. About 5 years ago, we started litigating cases in state public utilities commissions. The energy industry the energy sector is one of the most regulated sectors in the American economy. And that regulation happens on a state-by-state basis. So if you're a coal company, and you've got a dirty old coal-fired power plant, and you want to extend the life of that coal-fired power plant, you need to get permission from the State Public Utilities Commission in order to build the sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars in upgrading costs to your ratepayers, people like you and me. So we started going into these public utilities commissions. First of all, they were shocked to see somebody other than the regulated utility. I like to say we put the public back in the public utilities commission. But we went into these proceedings where the utility said, I want to stick you with a bill for $100 million to extend by 15 years the life of this dirty coal-fired power plant. And we didn't mention the word environment. These are some conservative states in Kentucky and Indiana, for example. Instead, we went in there and made the economic case that it is cheaper to provide the power that this upgrade to the coal-fired power plant would provide through solar, wind, and energy efficiency. And again, without mentioning the word environment and simply talking about cost to ratepayers, we've been winning those cases. Even if you put aside the environmental argument, which you should, obviously, but if you put it aside, we're moving in the right direction. And if we had more resources, we would do that in more states. So it's an example of why the premise of your question is exactly right, and it's one of the reasons why we're going to win.
I think I want to comment on that briefly, though. I mean, that's part of the reason that we sort of felt like we had a tailwind here in the Piance on our oil and gas work, because the price of natural gas has been so low for so long. And one political issue that has not, I think our politicians in this state have unanimously been in favor of some natural gas export facilities on the West Coast and pipelines and infrastructure to connect the Piceance Basin to those export facilities, which they haven't gotten an extraordinary amount of pushback on from folks who live here. And, you know, if you listen to the folks in the industry about the impact that that infrastructure and those export facilities would have on gas production of Piceance, it's pretty significant, which is concerning, I think, if you really care about our public lands. And I think it's an issue that we should all be a little bit more focused on. Because, and I think potentially be putting a lot of pressure on our political leaders so that they know that they can't just blindly support that kind of infrastructure without feeling some blowback from the public about it.
Again, make sure you're on the mailing list and we'll get you information on that.
You've talked quite a bit about how we're going to go to court and we're going to sue and we're going to lose some and win some and how everybody has to follow the law. That is true with judges who believe that. As many of us are aware, there are a number, not just the Supreme Court situation, but there are a number of lower courts where Trump and his minions are going to be putting in new judges. What do we do, or how can we as citizens help ensure that the kinds of judges that get appointed are not simply ideologues who follow whatever the Trumpies or the industries want them to say?
Well, it's a great question. There are more than 100 vacancies in the federal judiciary right now, and we expect that the new administration is going to move very quickly to try and fill those. And there aren't any nominees right now other than Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court, but I think that's going to change soon. And I'm concerned that those people are going to be selected on ideological grounds. I think just like every other, these are political decisions on the part of the Senate to confirm judges. So just like any other political decision, people can and should have their voices heard by their senators about not rubber stamping people who are not qualified to be judges or who have an inflexible viewpoint that they're going to try and legislate a right-wing ideology from the bench. I think it's important, though, not to get too pessimistic about that. There are hundreds and hundreds of federal judges sitting on the bench right now, and they all have lifetime tenure. And I can tell you that they're not going anywhere in the current administration unless they get hauled out feet first. So it takes a long time for the federal judiciary to turn over. And we can get fair hearings in almost every court in which we litigate in right now. And if we find ourselves in front of an unfair judge, we appeal his or her ruling. So those appointments are going to be important, and people need to raise their voices with their senators to have real scrutiny of those appointments. But I like our chances in any given federal court on any given day, and that's going to be true for years and years.
Okay, we'll just take two more questions. One from County Commissioner Rachel Richards. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for hosting. I was going to make a couple of quick comments if I could. One is do not send letters because they screen them all for toxic substances and takes 6 weeks before they're delivered. So don't send letters. Calls are much better than that. And the other thing I was kind of wondering, you could answer this afterwards, but are you funded by the Equal Access to Justice Law and how much are we depending on that? I serve on the National Association of Counties Public Land Steering Committee. And it's a very hostile room, believe you me, to Picken County values. But they are just feverish about getting rid of the Equal Access to Justice laws, and they believe it's just so high-priced lawyers for environmental groups can have a lifetime savings account and that it's not purposeful. So we see those under effect, and certainly they're rolling as quickly as they can, seeing this is their window for reform. To Endangered Species Act, Antiquities Act, things like that. So while they have to follow the current law, they can pass new laws. They could pass a new law totally modifying the Antiquities Act. And it's going to be up to public pressure to prevent that. So I was just going to add a few more things. You know, Picken County is trying to re-gear ourselves now. We're a small county and a tight budget under Tabor and other constraints here, but how do we respond more quickly to our public land threats? And so how do we, more effective than just sending a letter and passing resolutions? But I know everyone here is not picking county, or you have your own city council and town councils, but I'd love to see Snowmass and Aspen and Carbondale and some of these communities more involved with Colorado Municipal League to take positions, or they themselves as cities taking positions. So the more voices, the better, but ask your own council people or bring them a resolution or make sure they're aware of these issues and get them speaking out about this. And then, you know, the last thing I had really learned, which I was unaware of, so it's a trivial point here, but when they keep talking about the Congressional Review Act, we're going to get rid of this rule with the Congressional Review Act, that has a certain time limit of days, business days, that you can go backwards. And so that's why Congress didn't meet at all in 2016. So they literally could reach back into June of that year to start repealing the years, because it was only either 60 or 90 business days, whatever it was passed in last. So there's been a lot of real devious manipulation of laws. I certainly expect more, unfortunately. And so I really hope everyone stays as involved as they can. And the phone calls make a difference. I have been in the offices in D.C. watching the staffers tally on one sheet or another, you know, in which way it's running before that guy votes when the bell rings. So thank you.
Yeah, think of those, thanks, Christian. Think of those called as Chinese water torture. Grand Canyon was carved by drops of water.
This is the last question, then we'll adjourn to
Hi, I'm Danielle Stansted with Earth Justice, and thank you, Will, Peter, and Drew. I think you showed us all how important the power of partnership and the power of law is in this work. And I'm wondering if you could speak to what certain members of Congress are doing to reduce citizen access to courts.
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's what you raised in the Equal Access to Justice Act. The Equal Access to Justice Act is a federal law that says if you sue the government and you win, and the government's position in defending the lawsuit was not substantially justified as a matter of fact or law, you could bill them for your attorney fee costs in bringing that lawsuit. That is a lawsuit that is intended to make it possible for ordinary citizens with no resources to go to court and challenge not just the federal government with limitless resources, but their industry out. That is a really important thing that makes it opens the courthouse door for people. And there are other environmental statutes like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act that allow successful plaintiffs to recover their attorney's fees. About 5% of Earth Justice's annual budget is paid by attorney fee recoveries in the cases that we win. One of the ways these guys can shut us down is to make it harder for us to recover our attorney's fees, or to try and force us to pay the attorney's fees of not just the government but the industry if we lose, or make us go to binding arbitration rather than the federal court, or do a whole host of other things. And I am concerned about that, because I'm concerned that they're going to try and rewrite the Endangered Species Act. But when they do that, it's really obvious what they're doing. And we get to talk about bald eagles and grizzly bears and wolves. But when they start rewriting the Equal Access to Justice Act, or talking about binding arbitration or attorney's fees, that's a lot harder to talk about. So when you're making these phone calls, I hope you'll keep in mind how important it is to keep the courthouse doors open. Because being able to go to court not only allows us to stop really bad ideas in their tracks by getting a judge to order that something's illegal, the fact that we can go to court gives Peter and Will leverage when they're negotiating with industry to try and come to a resolution of something. Industry doesn't need that leverage. They have it because they're economically and politically powerful. But that's not true for the rest of us. So to the extent you can concentrate on that, you will help us, because the ability to go to court is what gives us our leverage. Okay. I was given the honor of closing this. I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. We often get asked, well, what can we do? And I want to suggest that there are two things you can do. If you believe in what Wilderness Workshop and Earth Justice are doing, and I encourage you to look seriously, we want to stand on our merits. If you believe in what we're doing,
consider supporting us. And just as importantly, consider talking to your friends about it. Because we're working on behalf of all of you and of our children and our children's children. One of the things our adversaries use in these fights to make it impossible to recover attorney fees is they say, we're in it for the money. Every lawyer that I hire at Earth Justice could make three times, straight out of law school, what I can pay them. Nobody does this for the money. They do it because they believe in it. And if you believe in us, I hope you'll consider supporting us and supporting Wilderness Workshop and other worthy groups and telling other people. The second thing is, and this has been a really wonderful theme of this meeting, is that speak up. Have your voice heard by elected officials and in the larger civic society, in the newspapers and elsewhere. America is still a democracy. One of the things we learned from the last election is that it's not a perfect democracy. And I won't pretend that if I call my congressperson and one of the Koch brothers calls their congressperson, because they have several billion dollars more in their bank account than I have in mine, I think their call is probably going to weigh more. But if we have thousands of ordinary Americans speaking up, it actually moves people. We have seen our government shift, sometimes for the worse, when there's some crazy, unfair, fake news attack on good things. But we can move things with people power. And in addition to that being really powerful, that's the tool that we've got. So stay involved. You have warmed my heart by being here tonight. And one of the great silver linings of the election is that we're all pulling together. We need to stay together, not just in the next 4 years, but we need to build a renewed movement, not just to stop bad things, but to make good things happen. And I feel growing confidence that with all of us working together, we can do that. So thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Take selfies.